This is Roger Lewis's third class at the Shippensburg This is Roger Lewis's second class at the Shippensburg Bible School. His theme for the week is God Manifestation, and the title of the class is Yahweh Revealed as a Father, Exodus 3, verses 11 to 15. Roger Lewis.
Well, good morning, everyone, and I hope you've all got paper and pencils poised. So we're going to start with our mind maps this morning, and as our chairman has rightly announced, our title for this morning is Yahweh Revealed as a Father. So remember, we're going to do a mind map. That becomes the title in the middle of the circle. So have you all got papers out, pencils? Let me see the evidence. I need to know that you've got this at the ready. Excellent. So wherever I look, I want to see papers and pencils out. Okay. Now, the reason is that, remember what we said yesterday, what's one of the, give me two critical benefits of mind maps.
How our minds work.
Yes, it's how our minds work. Yes, they could think in radiant format like a mind map. Yes, what else?
You remember pictures better than you remember them.
Yes, because it actually is like a form of picture, and the brain handles pictures well in terms of memory retention. And remember I said yesterday that once you develop the skill with mind maps, you can add colour and little images to it to make it even more dramatic, and the more colourful it is, the better the brain will remember it. So let's try our mind mapping then for purposes of our study this morning. And so now we're going to start with our first line coming out from the side of that circle. And that's just to start by making the point that when we talk about Yahweh, we need to understand that Yahweh and Father are not interchangeable or equivalent terms. The reason why I say that is because some people have suggested that in the Old Testament, Yahweh is the name of God, and that in the New Testament, the word Father has replaced Yahweh, and so he's Yahweh in the Old Testament and Father in the New. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right at all. And one of the reasons why I don't think that's right is because God as a Father was already taught in the Old Testament record long before the New Testament came along. So maybe the first line in our mind map should be something like, God as a Father in the Old Testament. And then what we need to do is to have maybe several lines coming out so that we can add some different lines of thought now to that central idea. So that's the first line radiating out from our mind map. God as a Father in the Old Testament. Well, let me give you two or three lines then to fill out here. Here's the first one. If you come to Proverbs chapter 3 for a moment, we're told in Proverbs chapter 3 that God has the attributes of a father. So that would be our next line. God has the attributes of a father. For example, in Proverbs 3 verse 12, it says, "For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as a father the son in whom he delighteth." So just like a father corrects or chastens a son, so does God, it says. God chastens his children. So he's like a father, you see. He's a father in that sense of correcting and guiding his children. And likewise, if you come to Psalm 103, we're told this in the 103rd Psalm, and in verse 13, it says there, "Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him." Like as a father pities his children. So that's interesting, because you notice that we've got two quotations here. Proverbs 3 and Psalm 103. What's Psalm 103 about in terms of what God does as a father? What is he doing in Proverbs 3? What's he doing in Proverbs 3 as a father? He is chastening his children. What's he doing in Psalm 103? He is pitying or loving his children in compassion. So actually, when you think about it, this is like the goodness and severity of God. God chastens in Proverbs, but he also praises and encourages. Psalm 103, he pities. He shows mercy. So you see, God's got that balance that every good father should have, that where there's a need for discipline, he will discipline his children, and where there's a need for praise and encouragement, he will praise his children. So God's got the attributes of a father. He's always been that, not just in the New Testament, surely. And if you come to Malachi chapter 2, here's our second line. The second line is that God is the creative source of all things, and therefore the father of all. God's the father of all creation, you could put as your line. The father of all creation, meaning, of course, that he made all things. Now, in Malachi chapter 2, it says this. Malachi chapter 2, verse 10 says, "Have we not all one father? Hath not one God created us?" So the fatherhood of God in Malachi chapter 2 is not so much about him guiding his children or correcting his children. It's about the fact that he fathered all things. He created and made all things. "Have we not one father? Hath not one God created us?" says Malachi chapter 2 verse 10. Now, a very good cross-reference for that is the 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 6, which says... In the 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 6, it's all part of that same idea. It says, "But to us there is but one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in him." There's one God, the Father, of whom are all things. Meaning, of course, same as Malachi, he made all things. He created all things. He's the Father of all things. Now, just a couple of notes about marginal references. I know you've all got different Bibles, and that's great, by the way, because the main thing is that we've all got a Bible. But can I suggest that as you move along life and you become serious about Bible study, that a really good thing to do is to get a Bible with great marginal references in the middle. So you know those marginal references in some Bibles? They're worth their weight in gold. Try and get a Bible that's got marginal references in the middle. It doesn't have to be the Bible you read from every day if you've got another Bible that you're already using. But even just to have one of those at home so that when you're reading a passage, you can check the marginal references because they're extremely helpful. And in my Bible, that reference to the 1 Corinthians chapter 8 is in the margin of Malachi chapter 2. Can anyone check that? Can you tell me whether you've got in Malachi chapter 2 verse 10, do you have in your margin a cross-reference to the 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 6? So can I see a show of hands of those that have got that reference? Okay, all right. Now, why that's interesting is because every one of you that didn't put up your hand, don't feel worried about that. If you haven't got a margin, you haven't got a margin. But my point is, if you haven't got a margin, you're missing out on stuff. You're missing out on a lot of excellent cross-references. Because do you know what Bible study's really about? Bible study's about two things. Well, it's about a whole lot of things, I suppose. But one of the things, it's about good Bible reading, careful Bible reading. And one of the things about careful Bible reading is that we hear Bible echoes, meaning that one passage says something, we think, oh, I can hear an echo from another part of Scripture in that passage. Now, where is that echo coming from? And tracking down that Bible echo to another part of Scripture is how we build our understanding of the Bible. So marginal references is actually, what it really is a nice little list of Bible echoes for you to hear. And if you haven't got those, you're going to miss out on a lot of richness of what the Scriptures are about. So try and get a Bible that's got marginal references if you possibly can, because it's going to be, I think, extremely helpful in the long term. So how many lines have we got to so far? How many lines are we down to? We've used how many? Two? All right. Well, we've used the first primary line, but of those subset lines, how many lines have we used so far? Can you tell me what you've got on your lines so far? So what have we got coming out here on these lines here? So what did we have to start with? Yeah, we got the quotes, but what was the idea? That God has the attributes of a father, Proverbs chapter 3 and Psalm 103. That was the first line. God's got the attributes of a father. What was the second line? That God is the creative source of all things as a father. Malachi chapter 2, 1 Corinthians chapter 8. So you see how you're using your lines here? right? So here's a third one now. God is the Father of Israel. So he's the Father of the nation in some special and particular sense. Now, we're told that if you come to Deuteronomy chapter 32. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, we're told this in the words of Moses. So this is our third line. He's got the attributes of a father. He's got the creative power of a father because he made all things. But he's also more particularly the father of the nation of Israel. And that's what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 6. Do ye thus requite the Lord, O foolish people and unwise? Is not he thy father that hath bought thee? He is thy father that hath bought thee. So God was the father of the nation of Israel. Now, another quotation for that, Isaiah chapter 63 and verse 16. So Isaiah 63 verse 16 says, you don't need to turn it up, I'll just read it to you, but you might like to add it to your mind map. It says, doubtless thou art our father, though Abraham be ignorant of us and Israel acknowledge us not, thou, O Yahweh, art our father, our Redeemer. In fact, notice what it says, thou, O Yahweh, art our Father. So Yahweh and Father can't be the same thing, because Isaiah 63 says, O Yahweh, thou art our Father, which is obviously different to the divine name of God himself. So God is both Yahweh the Elohim of Israel, but he's also our Father. So just one final reference before we move off that line. And that's the 1st of Chronicles chapter 29. Because in the 1st of Chronicles chapter 29, we're given a reference in the prayer of David that in fact clearly understands that. It was the very last prayer that David gave. As an old man, he gave this prayer, we're told, in the 1st of Chronicles chapter 29. It says in the 1st of Chronicles 29 and verse 10, wherefore David blessed Yahweh before all the congregation, and David said, blessed be thou, Yahweh Elohim of Israel. So Yahweh Elohim of Israel is really like saying Yahweh Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then he says, our Father forever and ever. So that's the way David called him. David described him as Yahweh Elohim of Israel, our Father. And that really brings us then to the matter of the divine name in the book of Exodus in chapter 3, which was announced as the reading. So now we're going to start a second line, which is really related to the name of God. So let's just start on our mind map then at that next stage. So now we're saying we've got another line coming out. And what I'm going to do is just leave that line blank for a moment and ask you shortly what you think this line should be about. In fact, because we are going to spend almost the rest of this session about that, we might put it over here. So you've got one coming out this way and one coming out this way. And likewise, we're going to have perhaps several lines of evidence coming out from this one line of the mind map. So I'll come back later on and ask you what you think perhaps we should write in that along that line. Well, come to Exodus chapter 3, and let's just have a look at the divine name. I don't know if you've ever heard anything about the divine name before, but it's a really good thing to get to grips with early on in your Bible studies and in your Bible understanding. And it's also a really good thing to do to do a bit of marking on it in your Bible itself. In fact, can I just give you a handy hint with regard to Bible marking? Bible marking. You know, did I mention this yesterday about boxes? Did I mention about boxes or margin? Margin or box? So I think that this is box. Today we're talking a box. So if you can fit it in your margin, that's fine. But it might be the best thing to do today to put it in a box. And there are two or three different boxes that we may want to create here. Well, here's the first box. We're going to look at the subject of Ayah Asher Ayah. Now, where do those mysterious words turn up in Exodus chapter 3? Can someone tell me? So where are these words in Exodus chapter 3? Does anyone know? Where are those words? Verse 14. Absolutely right. Which words are they?
I am that I am.
Okay. So here we have the famous I am that I am. Very good. So now what's interesting about I am that I am is this. I am is the ayah. The that is the Hebrew word asher. And the that I am is back to ayah again. So there's only three words in the Hebrew. Even though it says I am that I am, there's only three Hebrew words. I am, ayah, that, asher, I am, ayah. But there's a little problem. The problem is that this word ayah doesn't mean I am. It doesn't mean I am. Let me show you another place in this very chapter where this word is used. Do you notice in verse 11 for connection, says, Moses said unto God, Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, Certainly I will be with thee. Now you see that word, I will be. Well, that's the word ayah, found in verse 14. Now, what's the difference between I am in verse 14 and I will be in verse 12? What's the difference? What's the difference? Any guesses? It's not a trick question, so you're probably right if you're thinking what you're thinking. Yes? Sorry?
There is
no difference? Yes, there is a difference. Yes? Exactly. One is present, I am, and one is future, I will be. They're two quite different tenses. So this word ayah, as it's going to be found here, in over 40 times that it's used, I think only apart from one other place compared to Exodus 4 verse 14, apart from one other place, in every other place it's translated I will I be, I shall I be. It's all future, 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 future. So ayah is a future word. It's in the future tense. Now that changes our thinking about this phrase, because if God said, I am that I am, then obviously he would be talking about, well, what he's doing in the present. But if he says, I will be, what or who or that I will be, then he's talking about his intentions for the future. And that future aspect is very important concerning the meaning of this word. Now, let me just give you Brother Thomas then in terms of his explanation of this particular phrase or passage. Now, this sounds a bit heavy going. It sounds a bit sort of wordy, but when you stop and get your heads around it, you'll find it's very, very helpful. Before I do say that or put that on the screen, this word ayah is the verb of the Hebrew, which simply means to exist. And it's the most common language, it's the most common or simple verb in any language is the verb to be, to exist. I am, I are, I exist as a person, either past, present or future. So this is what Brother Thomas says concerning ayah, asher, ayah. He says the eternal spirit, what does he mean by that, by the way? What does he mean by saying the eternal spirit? What does that mean? Any thoughts on that? What's he saying? Who does he mean? It's just Brother Thomas's way of describing God the Father himself, the actual Father himself, the eternal spirit. He calls him that, you see. The eternal spirit in imposing upon himself a name. By the way, why did he have to impose upon himself a name? Why did he even have to do that? Because Moses said, didn't he? He said, well, look, when I come, verse 13, when I come before the children of Israel and say that you've sent me, that they're going to say, well, what's his name? What's the name of this God? So God chooses a name to answer Moses. And Brother Thomas says he selected a word which would point toward this wonderful future manifestation of the Spirit. So now see what he says. The memorial in its simplest form is ayah, asher, ayah. I will be who I will be. Now notice that, who, not that, not I am that I am, but I will be who I will be. Now what's interesting about that word asher is that the relative pronoun asher is both singular and plural, masculine and feminine. So let me just ask you a question. Why do you think that's significant? I'll just go back a step. Think about it. I will be, says God, I will be revealed in who I will be. In who I will be revealed. Now, Brother Thomas says that word who, sitting in the middle, is both singular, but it could also be plural. It could be masculine, or it could be feminine. So why do you think that's interesting that that particular word would be chosen in Exodus chapter 3 concerning God's purpose to reveal himself in others? Any thoughts on that? Yeah. Yep, that's good. That's very good. Very good. Excellent answer. So he could reveal himself in anyone he wanted. It could be male, it could be female, it could be a single person, it could be a multitude, it could be all of those things. And I think that's exactly why that word was chosen, you see. That God intended to reveal himself in all sorts of different people, a multitude of men and women, and also in one single person and in a whole multitude of people. So a word was chosen in the Hebrew that actually managed to represent all of those things. Now, as Brother Thomas says, it will therefore stand for 10,000 times 10,000, as well as for two or three or even one persons. I will be who I will be could still be God revealed in just one single person. And that would still be Aya, Asher, Aya. So that's the word Asher. That's quite helpful, you see. Now, here's the word Aya. The other two words of the memorial are the first person singular future tense of the verb hire to be. So there's our future tense, you see. So it's in the future, it's I will be, not I am. So that's good to know. In this memorial, now see if you can get your head around this one, this is like a riddle. In this memorial, the eternal spirit is the I will be. And the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the who, of whom it is memorialized that they shall be. Woof, that's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? So what is Brother Thomas saying? He's simply saying that when you put all this together, this is God, and he intends to reveal himself in a multitude of people, and those multitude of people are those that will be the revelation of God. Did you get all those little wee pointers there? So it's actually a really interesting title when you stop and think about it, because hidden in this title is the whole purpose and intention of God to reveal himself. So one last question that comes out of this, and this is very helpful. Verse 15 of Exodus chapter 3. God said unto Moses, thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, Yahweh Elohim of your fathers hath sent me unto you. The Elohim of Abram, the Elohim of Isaac, and the Elohim of Jacob. Now, I've got a question for you. Why does Exodus chapter 3 change from the word Ayah in verse 14 to suddenly talk about Yahweh in verse 15? This is a really good question. Can you find a really good answer, or can you think of an answer? So I'll ask it again. Why is it that God refers to himself as Ayah in verse 14, but we're then told that the name of God is Yahweh in verse 15? Does anyone know the answer to that puzzle? All right, I'm really pleased that no one put their hand up, because now I can give you a box, you see. So here's the answer. It's so simple, but it's really good. And by the way, this is why you've got to take notes, because you see, if you've never heard this before, I would hate you to go away and have lost this within 24 hours at this school. I would be so disappointed, because this might be one of the most useful things that you'll hear. So here it is. It's simple, really. Aya means I will be. What do you think Yahweh means? Have a guess. What does Yahweh mean? You're almost there. Just say that again. Add one more word in the front of that and you're spot on. What word would you add? He who will be. Yes. So here's the difference. Aya, I will be. Who would ever use the word Aya? I will be. Who would ever use the word Aya when you think about it? God himself talking about himself. I will be. So when he refers to himself, he would use the word Ayah, which is what he's saying in verse 15. Well, he says, I am Ayah. I'm Ayah. I will be. But when other people are talking to God, they can't say, I will be, can they? Because that's God's name for himself. What do we say? We say, he who will be, and that's Yahweh. So the difference between Ayah and Yahweh is they're in fact exactly the same word, but the difference is that one is the verb and one is the noun of exactly the same word. Does that make good sense? So if you've ever puzzled over, well, what's all this Ayah business in Exodus and how does that become Yahweh? It's simple. Ayah is God's name for himself, which we can't use because we're not him. And Yahweh is the word that we use to describe exactly the same person. It's simply the same word in verb or noun form. So Yahweh is the Ayah of verse 14. So I think that's very helpful, isn't it? Just in terms of making that clear. So by the way, if you decided what you'd put here, what would you put, do you think, so far? What would you put on that line? This first line is Ayah Asher Ayah. We've looked at the significance of Ayah Asher Ayah. So what would you put on this line here, do you think? Well, just hold your judgment and we'll come back to that in a minute. Now, reading on in the book of Exodus here, it says this in verse 15. It says, God said moreover unto Moses, thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, Yahweh Elohim of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial. Now, do you notice how those two phrases sort of run side by side? This is my name, and this is my memorial. See how those two things are linked together? Now, let me just show you this on screen, because again, this is probably our second line, by the way. So this is our second thought coming out of Exodus, and that's this. My name and my memorial, these two ideas are actually linked together. And clearly, they are paralleled in the text. So the name of Yahweh is a memorial of his character and of his intention and of his purpose. So when he says, this is my name and this is my memorial, what he's really saying is that his name stands for something. It means something. It's a memorial of something, a memorial of his character and his purpose. Now, by the way, our names are like this as well, or at least some of our names. Names have meaning. Well, certainly Hebrew and Greek names do, and lots of other people's names do. Who's got a Hebrew name or a Greek name and knows what it means? Yes? The lady in red, and then followed by the lady in... Are you in pink? Would you say that you're in pink? Or is it orange? Or is it peach? Well, let's have your two names.
I'm Chloe.
You're Chloe and it means
green.
Green? Really? Chloe means green. Wow. I didn't know that. That's really nice. And you are?
I'm Bethel.
You're Bethel, which means the house of God. Now, you know, when parents name a child, either Chloe or Bethel, they probably had a reason. They probably either wanted you to be fresh and green like the Passover spring shoots, or a tabernacle for the thinking of the Father and the house of God in your life. But they would have thought about all those sorts of things when they chose a name. And what they hope is that when you grow up, that name will actually memorialize who you really are as a person, you see. Well, God's name's like that. It's the memorial of all his intention. So when he says, well, my name is Yahweh, what he's really saying is, that's the memorial of everything I plan to do. So every time a person uses my name, they're reminded of what I intend to do. So, in the scriptures, we'll find that those two ideas are brought together over and over and over. We won't have time to look at these because we haven't got time to look at these. But the point that I was going to make was, maybe if we just look at a couple of those, where are we? Let's try Job 18, verse 17. We'll just look at a couple of them. I just want to establish that... what I'm saying is right, is that these two words, name and memorial, are often brought together in the narrative. So in Job 18, in verse 17, for example, it says, his memorial shall perish from the earth. And that's another way of saying, he shall have no name in the street. So his memorial has perished from the earth, he shall have no name in the street. So the person's name is the person's memorial, almost like their reputation, their character is all tied up in the meaning of their name. When that person's name is gone, so is their memorial. And those two ideas are brought together. Well, let's just look at one other one of those. Let's say Psalm 135 and verse 13. So Psalm 135, but all of those passages are very similar in this respect, that they consistently bring those two ideas together. In Psalm 135 and verse 13, it says, "Thy name, O Yahweh, endureth forever, and thy memorial, O Yahweh, throughout all generations." And in fact, in my margin, I've got a cross-reference to why. Where would we have a cross-reference to? Surprise, surprise, in our margins, Exodus chapter 3, verse 15. That's why marginal references are so rich and so helpful. It's telling us in the book of Psalms that this idea probably goes all the way back to the giving of the memorial name to Moses in Exodus chapter 3. Now, this word memorial, I wanted just to mention something about the word memorial. In the Hebrew, the word memorial is zikah from zakah, which means to mark so as to recognize. Who's interested in marking out a family name? Well, can I just ask that question? Who's interested in marking out a name so that they recognize it? The answer is, well, to start with, the father of a family is very interested in his name. It might be a matter of pride, but they tend to be very interested in their household name. So they mark it out. And as the sons and daughters grew up, hopefully they mark out the family name because it's important to them as well. And they want to honour that name and live up to that name. Excuse me, let me tell you a story from my own life. My father came from Glasgow when he was a wee little laddie. At about 8, he came to live in New Zealand. But he was from Scotland when he was a wee boy. And my father's name was Alexander Lewis. And his father's name was Robert Lewis, and his father's name was Alexander Lewis, because in Scotland the heritage is that every little boy, every firstborn son receives his grandfather's name. So it goes Robert Alexander, Robert Alexander, Robert. So that's the Scottish way, you see. Now what's interesting is that my father was an only child. So you see, therefore the whole fate of the House of Lewis hung on my father, because if he died or didn't have a family, the family name was going to be extinguished, you see. And what's interesting is that my father's father was also a single child. So the fate of the House of Lewis hung in the balance in terms of grandfather, whether he'd have any children or not. And my father's father's father was a single child. So for three generations, the House of Lewis hung by a thread. It was touch and go as to whether it would survive or not. Now, you know, it's an interesting thing. When I was born, what happened was this. I've got two older sisters, you see, and my grandfather Lewis, when my oldest sister was born, he said to my dad, he says, "What's a child? You've had a baby." And Dad said, "We've had a beautiful little girl, Grandpa." He said, "We're going to call her Vivian." And my grandfather said, "Och, that's nice." And then there was another child born, and grandfather said, What's the babe?" And Dad said to him, "We've had another beautiful little girl, Dad." He said, "That we're going to call her Susan." And Grandpa Lewis said, "Och, that's nice." And then there was a third child born, which was me, you see. And Grandfather said, "What's the baby?" And my dad said, "We've had a little boy, Dad." And Grandpa said, "A son." Now, it wasn't because he thought that sons were any better than daughters, but you see, a son carried on the family name. He just said, "A son." And you see, in that little expression was all the fervency of how he felt, you see. He'd been an only child, his father had been an only child, his son was an only... So, of course, I came along, and I had three sons to make sure that the House of Lewis was safe and sound for generations to come. And I've told all my boys to go forth and be fruitful and multiply exceedingly so that we can fill the... Well, not quite so, but you know what I mean. So, you see... The family name becomes a memorial of everything that family stands for. So if we were to ask who marks out a family name, to start with, well, it's the father. It's so important to him. But he hopes that as his children grow up, that they want to mark out that name as well. So the Yahweh name is a memorial to the generation of the race. They've marked that name so that they, of all people, recognize it. Now you might think, now, what's that? Where did he say generation of the race? Where does that come from? Well, that's the next stage of our session this morning out of Exodus chapter 3. So we've got 5 minutes left. Let's just come back to Exodus 3 and just look at this last line. So now we're on to our third line. So we've had Aya, Asher, Aya. We've had the name and the memorial. And now we've got the last phrase out of Exodus chapter 3. What does it say in Exodus 3? Can someone give it to me? It's at the end of verse 15. What does it say in our Bibles? Someone like to read it? So it just says in our Bibles, this is my name forever, and this is my memorial, here's the phrase, unto all generations. That's all it says in our Bible. Now, what's interesting about that, though, is this. It doesn't quite mean what it seems to mean or seems to say, unto all generations. So the authorized version that we use does say unto all generations. But Rodham's translation from the Hebrew says unto generation after generation. And Green's, which is another translation of the Hebrew, says from generation to generation of generation. And Brother Thomas says, no, no, it actually means to a generation of the race. And by the way, that's quite a good translation from the Hebrew. Now the question is, what do you think Brother Thomas meant when he took that phrase from generation to generation, said, no, it actually means to a generation of the race. Not to a generation of the generations, but to a generation of the race. Well, he did that, I think, for a very good reason. And that reason was this. So let me put it up on screen. Because I don't believe that Exodus chapter 3 is saying that the Yahweh name is his name and his memorial to all people on the earth. Let's face it, how many people that you know that aren't Christadelphians do you think know about the Yahweh name and the purpose of God to manifest himself in the multitude, whether male or female, singular or plural? How many people know that you know? The answer is probably none of them. So Yahweh is not a memorial to them. His name is not a memorial to them, is it? So who is the name a memorial to, or who marks out that name so that they do recognize it? What generation marks the name out? What would you say? What generation marks the name of God out so that they, of all people, recognize it, never forget it? What generation is that? Have a guess. Och, you're such a talkative lot. Didn't it all speak at once? Any thoughts? All right, let me put it on screen. And if you have been thinking something, you can look at the screen and nod wisely and say, yes, that's what I was thinking. All right, so here we go. In the theological word book of the Old Testament, it's a book about Hebrew words, it says that the word generation here means the circle of a man's lifetime from birth to death, more frequently of the circle of a man's life from his conception and birth until the conception and birth of his offspring. But here's the key thing. By a natural transition, this word is used widely in a metaphorical sense to distinguish a class of man distinguished by a certain moral or spiritual character. In other words, a generation could represent a certain style of person. Not an actual generation of history, but a generation of a style of person. Now have a look at this. The divine name was a prophecy of his intention, I believe, with only one single generation. And that generation is what Brother Thomas describes as the generation of the race. In other words, it's the special generation of the saints taken from all generations of time. So if we imagine the generations of time, we go all the way back to Adam here, we come all the way through to Christ here, we come all the way through to the kingdom here. In every generation of time of man, one or two people have been taken out. One or two people are taken out. One or two people taken out. One or two people taken out of that generation. When you put all of those people together, you've now got the generation of the race, which is the special generation of God's people over all time. Not all the generations of mankind know this name, and they're not the slightest bit interested in it, but the generation of the race are. the saints of God are, you see. Now, if we just have a look at a couple of those passages before we close, because I think we've just got a couple of minutes. Let's just look at one of them. Psalm 22, verse 30. This is just an illustration of this idea, but again, this would make a great little box, I think, at the bottom of Exodus chapter 3, the generation of the race. So in Psalm 22, it says this in verse 30. It's talking about the kingdom age, by the way. It says this, verse 30. A seed shall serve him, and it shall be accounted to the Lord for a generation. So it's not just an ordinary generation of people. It's a special generation of those who are prepared to serve him. So these people in Psalm 22 and verse 30 are part of the generation of the race, that unique generation of people from all time who've been called into the purpose of God. Those people mark the name of God and want to know about it and recognize it in their lives. So if we were to summarize this, Ayah Asher Ayah, my name and my memorial, the generation of the race, what do you think now we'd put in this line here? Well, let me give you a final slide, and then I'll ask you that question just before we close. Yahweh manifested as a father. The term father, when applied to Yahweh, is highly expressive of his intention to create offspring who are his children. Because they are his sons and daughters, they reveal the family characteristics of the father, for they are like him. His children, by their demeanor and speech and attitude, reflect their origin and can therefore be recognized as belonging to the family. They preserve the memorial of the family name and are the generation of the race which the father has produced. We've been created in the image and likeness of God. It was the intention of Yahweh from the beginning, therefore, to populate the earth with his own family who think, now notice this, who think, that's mental, and act, what's that? That's moral, and look, what's that? That's physical, like him. Now we're not made like God yet, but we will be when we receive glorified bodies, but here's the key, we'll only be given immortal bodies like God if we have already learnt to think and act like him first. So when you look at the children of this father, you recognize them as belonging to the family, and they belong to the family name. So today we've looked at the Yahweh name, he who will be manifested in a multitude of the mighty ones of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But do you know, I think that really what that's all about is, now give me the line, he who will be manifested in a multitude of people, what's that really saying that God intended to do? If he's going to be revealed in a multitude of sons and daughters, what has he become? He's become a father. It's all about his fatherhood, isn't it? He's going to father all of these offspring. So, well, we're going to put the line here. Any thoughts? What have you written down? Anyone written something down? By the way, there's no necessarily right thing, so you can write whatever you like on your line. But what would you write? Having summarized all of that out of Exodus chapter 3, what would you write? Now, this time I am going to wait for an answer rather than try and supply one. So, would someone please help to bring the class to an end? What would you write? Whatever you say, by the way, we'll take and massage it as a group until we get something really crisp and succinct and sharp and concise to put on that line. So if you're going to summarize Ayah Asher Ayah, the name and the memorial, and the generation of the race, what would you put on that little line? Give me a thought. Yes.
God's name reveals himself as the father of a special generation that came through that.
Whoa. Just as well we had a long line. You know, that's pretty good. Would you like to hear that again? That's pretty good. Now you write something down like that, and once you've got it down in front of you, you can say, oh, I can get rid of a word there. Oh, I could make two words into one there. And you can crisp that up, can't you? So give that to me again.
God's name reveals himself as the father of a special generation over time that came through us.
Okay. Right. God's name reveals himself as the father of a special generation. What was the rest of it?
Over time,
that can include us. Now, if you write that down or something like that, I'd be very happy with what you've got on your mind map. And you could then seek to just abbreviate that slightly as you please. That's great. Thanks for that, and thanks for class this morning.